are listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To subscribe to this podcast, visit questformeaning.org or search for Church of the Larger Fellowship in the iTunes Store.
Hey, good morning. Sorry we're a couple minutes late. We had technical difficulties here on Google on the Air, but delighted to be here this morning. I'm in Minneapolis, Minnesota. We have a couple of special guests we're really excited about, and we'll get right to them after we introduce our usual panelists. Hey, Michael.
Good morning, everyone. This is Michael Tino joining you from Peekskill, New York, where I think fall might actually have finally arrived.
I'm Aisha Hauser, and I'm in Seattle, Washington, where kind of seasons blend together. You know, I mean, some of the trees are changing, but it's not quite, I don't know that I'd call it fall.
And on tech, we have Jessica Starrockers, also out there in the Seattle area. So I've asked Aisha to take the lead today. We're really rotating leadership here, and kind of whoever thinks of this show is in charge of it. So I'm really excited about this show. I think it's a really important conversation we're about to have. So take it away, Aisha.
Thank you. Yes, I am so excited to have both Doreau Farrar, Director of Music at the First Unitarian Church in Portland, Oregon, and Dr. Glenn Thomas Rideout, Director of Worship and Music at the First Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Ann Arbor, Michigan. Welcome, both of you. This is so exciting, because we are going to talk about Unitarian Universalism and Universalists, music and appropriation. So I first want to start, because both of you have, reached UU fame, I would say, for different, you know, Doreau, a lot of your writings have been online, and your testimony that you did in May has gone viral. And Glenn Thomas, of course, your amazing worship at General Assembly in Columbus has also just been everywhere. So I would love to hear from both of you. I think the first question for me is, what is it like for both of you to work in mostly white settings? I mean, both of you are we're in a predominantly white denomination, but each of you work for large, mostly white congregations. So we could start with whoever is moved to speak first. Doreau.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll start by saying that I am trained as a classical musician, which I guess is another way of saying I am trained to work in white spaces. When you are trained in classical music, there's hardly ever this illusion that you are working for, or that you're going to work for, a predominantly audience of color. And so my whole professional path has been sort of in this direction of understanding that white wealthy audiences are going to be my people. So it doesn't feel so different from that, which we could talk about at some point whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it doesn't feel so different from my expectations.
I wrote as a first point, this is my journey. I wrote that verbatim, and I think Doreau and I are talking about similar things. I mean, my degrees are in voice and choral conducting, and what I learned and had to come into a really complicated relationship with over the course of my studies is precisely that those degrees, those generalized degrees in voice, really mean a very certain type of Eurocentric training. With repertoire, with even style of the training. And there were certain relationships with certain types of music that I had to sever, at least put on pause in order to concentrate my attention in that way. As a matter of fact, by the time I was doing my doctoral thesis work, we do a document, but it's primarily through recitals. And my recitals concentrated on a lot on repositioning Black music, in particular the spiritual, in positions of power in traditionally Eurocentric recital spaces. And I certainly bring that work to the conversation of the really messy conversation of the Black music's place in the rich white congregation. I saw that transfer very directly into the conversations that I'm having right now in my UU congregation.
When you both first started working for your congregations, was there something in the hymnal that surprised you that even existed there? Because I know for me, I think the song is No More Auction Block for me. I couldn't, what? So I'm wondering if you all had those reactions at some of the songs in the hymnals.
Yeah, same song.
Right?
As you were asking the question, I was typing No More Auction Block for me. But also, Oh Freedom. You know, and the idea of before I be a slave, I be buried in my grave. And there was this entering into a Unitarian congregation for the first time, because this is the first one for me 10 years ago. I was adjusting my understanding and growing a relationship with a stranger, the Unitarian Universalists. And then I read the texts of those hymns, which wouldn't have even appeared in my African Methodist hymnal, really. I read those texts and it occurred to me that the Unitarians are doing some similar work of navigating a very awkward relationship, trying to grow sort of roots that reach out to different peoples. And those occurred to me as predictable, yet I'd say regrettable steps along the larger journey.
Well, say more about that, because I think part of what startled me is, and I don't know anything about how that gray hymnal was put together. I know nothing. I can't even pretend to know. But I wonder, clearly it was done by committee, but I wonder, you know, I mean, I almost feel like it needs a whole complete, we need to shut it down and do something completely different. But what I don't know, how do you say to people, do either of you ever explicitly say, I am never, do people ask you in your choir, say, oh, could we do whatever it is? And you say, no, and here's why we're not doing this. Do you have those conversations?
Yeah, absolutely. I think for those of us who work with choir or who work with music ensembles in general in churches, we have a particular on-ramp to these sorts of complex conversations about culture and race that other disciplines don't have as easy an on-ramp to. And I think it's because we tangle with beauty all the time, and we tangle with other people's beautiful constructions in this thing we call a universal language. So, you know, with that commonality of music between us, for some reason, I think we feel more permission, or at least more space, to explore the cultures of others. And that also means that in that exploration, I get, I think, far more, into far more upfront conversations about culture and cultural appropriation and cultural appropriation mistakes and things like that than some of my fellow staff members, because it is just the water we're constantly swimming in.
Yeah, I'll say the same things. We're uniquely positioned for this strange work of sort of translating expectations and desires of our congregants and often our ministers into a contemporary understanding of what it means to live our values through this music as Unitarian Universalists and as, you know, liberal-minded people. When I look at the gray hymnal, and I'm mindful that many of the folks that worked on that hymnal are still among us, and one of them is my predecessor here in Portland. But I see that it is a response. It is a response to a way of being. It's what I see is a response to some sort of guilt around being oh so white. The Unitarian Universalists for a long time have been sort of living in this strange space of we need to diversify, yet we do, you know, we're wealthy white people just like we have been for centuries, and how do we do that? And I think that anxiety shows up not only in the gray hymnal but also in the teal hymnal and also in the purple hymnal, and we have to figure out a way to own that and find better ways to respond to these questions of diversity and these questions of multiculturalism.
Yeah, I think it's, isn't it really common for people systems who want to diversify to do so by, you know, this sort of affirmative action approach? And it's not I don't think it's necessarily anything to shun, but I think it's something to notice and name that that one of the symptoms of the congregation trying to diversify its membership is those of us who believe that we do that through bringing Black, Brown people into the church, when such a thing is a symptom rather than a primary mode of operation. I think the cultural diversifications of our congregations will happen as a result of relationships that we tend over time, and those things will be reflected in who we attract and who and what kind of relationships we sustain. And I think the same is true with hymnals and music, that that the diversification has to come through deeper relationships with the music itself and the people and the lives and the deaths that that bring the music about. And what I see with these, I can't help but see the hymns like "No More Auction Block for Me" and "Oh Freedom," and these almost isolated hymns that are standing in the presence, surrounded completely by, and when you close the hymnal, completely almost choked by the surroundings of a very Eurocentric, very Christian forward set of hymns around it. It's almost like those individual ones are being asked to do the larger work that they can't sustain on their own. And they kind of remind me of me, you know, the being the sometimes and a lot of times the Black voice in the room, surrounded by voices that are not like mine, trying to speak up for the perspective and doing work that sustainably I cannot do on my own without there being a larger effort for cultivating deeper relationships.
Well, Thomas, I'm curious. I got this packet from Erica Hewitt that I haven't honestly read yet, but I just saw that it exists, to encourage our congregations to give money to support the Black Lives of UU $5 million fundraising thing. And it's a worship service, it looks like, created all by people of color, decentering whiteness and really featuring, you know, real centering of people of color's voices. I was wondering, because I saw that you worked on that, if doing that felt really different for you from working the way that you usually do, or what that was like to be part of that. And as I say, I haven't looked at it, so this may be a really stupid question, but I'm curious to get at it. I just noticed this morning that it's out. Did that feel different? Did you work as a collective to do that, or did you each just contribute kind of from your own places for it?
So I can say I had only a very small role in the construction of that packet. I was grateful to have it, but my contributions were mostly, I think we were asked to contribute songs of different types according to the larger themes that were going on in the worship service that's prescribed in the resources. I'm not sure that I can give a real full answer with this project in particular, but I will say that it has been interesting and a bit unexpected to, especially in the last couple of years, to begin thinking of myself as, I'll say the term and then I'll explain it, and sort of thinking of myself as primarily a Black musician. I think part of that is because of the training that Duro and I talked about. I mean, we really have been prepared to operate in sort of a different audience and a different context. But with the rise of the conversation of decentering whiteness and what does Blackness and brownness look like for the modern Unitarian Universalist congregation rose up, suddenly there began this opening for Black and brown voices to contribute to that. And I will admit some discomfort with the sudden laser focus on the Blackness of my musical contributions, partly because academically I'm not trained in that way, and there's so many musicians of color who could give us a run for our money specifically in that, but also because of the feeling of added pressure to speak for Black and Brown people at such an important moment in the denomination's history, the feeling that each of my song suggestions could go down in the annals of the foundations of what decides whether we will continue as a culturally pluralistic people. That sort of pressure has been a bit much. One that I think is worth taking on, but one that's taken a lot of adjustment to feel out, and it's still taking some adjustment.
And I'll say my contribution was a little bit different for that, in that I'm a church musician, and I was asked to write one of the homilies for The Promise and the Practice, which was a joy for me to do. But that's also not what I'm hired to do. I'm hired to bring music in worship. And it's sort of been interesting to echo part of what Glenn Thomas was saying. I have seen my work over this past year or so transfer to start including ministry for white people needing to understand race. Whereas I thought I was being hired to be a musician. The musician side of me is tending less and less to use and present Black music, because I don't want it to be seen as being associated with any sort of agenda or racial agenda. I think the music of my people, the music of my ancestors, deserves to be used and respected outside of our understanding of race, whatever that is. And so I end up using more Bach and more Mozart, because even to have conversations about race, because we have this habit as liberal white people have this habit of wanting to talk about race and talk about diversity, and to do that, use music from other cultures. Whereas the messaging can come from any piece of music. And in fact, I think it's sometimes better served when it does. So it's been an interesting time, to say the very least. I didn't have the sense when you say things like, I forget the words you used, Aisha, that you said something about going viral, and you said something about people sort of zeroing in on Glenn Thomas and I and perhaps others. And I have not sensed that. So I'm grateful. I'm grateful to be here in Portland and not know perhaps the full extent of of the reach of my words.
It's wide.
I just want to apologize for not acknowledging your contribution to that packet as well. As I said, I haven't looked at it yet, and I'm excited to. And is that the same homily that's on video that's in it?
No, it's not. I was asked to write something different.
Okay. Because that video piece, I will say, many groups, including CLF, have been talking about and looking at that video. And you haven't been aware of the large denominational response to that. People haven't been talking to you about it, apparently.
I get the occasional note saying thank you from some strange place across the country, but I don't understand how far it's gone, and I'm glad to not understand how far it's gone.
Then I won't tell you. We used it in our teach-in, and you wrote something in February, Wait, Am I Your Negro? Which was brilliant. And I used that in the West Seattle teach-in. But that's an aside. I do want to ask you both, because I've been asked this question, and I don't have a good answer for it. A, because I'm not a musician, even as a religious educator, I've been struggling with this myself. So when is using music not from your culture of origin, mostly it's white people doing this, when is it appreciation and when is it misappropriation? I'd love for you both to speak to that, because like I said, I don't ever have a good answer that really, I don't know what a definitive, if there is a definitive answer, or what really makes the most sense in our spaces.
I guess I'm gonna start, because I'm getting high eyebrows from Dr. Rideout.
I mean, no matter how many times you get asked the question, the largeness of it comes on like a wave.
That's right. Yeah. here's my sense of it, Aisha. Music from all around the world and music from the diversity that this country offers should be used, and it should be used by all of us, and it should be appreciated by all of us, because there's such a richness there, and there's just such a wealth there of artistry and of culture and of understanding that we can gain from that. My understanding of appropriation is when music is not in the question of how music is used on a performance or a sort of engagement level. So sure, we can sing spirituals in church. As far as I'm concerned, the choirs can sing it, the church can sing it. We can sing gospel music. We can sing music in Spanish. As far as I'm concerned, it's about who benefits from the use of that music. So if we're going to use De Colores, which is one that I never use, but if we're going to use De Colores in our worship services, are we doing it because it's Cinco de Mayo? Are we doing it because we are trying to reach out to the Latinx population in our neighborhood? Are we using it because whatever reason that has nothing to do with our heart center, our spiritual center? Then that needs to be questioned. But if there's some message in De Colores that is key to what we are talking about for the day, if there's some central message that is reached in De Colores that is not reached in another piece of music necessarily, that seems fine to me. The other part of it is when my choir sings a piece of music from Brazil, is that piece of music actually from Brazil? Or did someone go to Brazil, learn how to imitate that style, or maybe even learn a folk song from Brazil, come back and monetize it in the States? And is that what my choir is singing? Because that's another level of appropriation, because no one in Brazil or of Brazilian descent is benefiting from that. It is really some other person monetizing the culture of someone else. You know, we think for our benefits, but turns out it's not so.
So I think we get into a little of a bramble when we try to figure out what the appropriate appreciation versus the appropriation looks like, because like I said earlier, that what we're trying to do is describe the symptom. We're trying to really measure the symptom for its quality. When I think, in some ways, when folks are operating in a beautiful sense of appreciation, there are some things that are going to look a whole lot like those people appropriating. My point is the surface, I don't think, is an accurate barometer for measurement of whether we're getting it right. And I also resist the idea of rightness and wrongness in the conversation in general. I think it's far more complex than that. But I think what we ought to start getting down to is a far more elusive means of measuring, and that's looking at this gets into what Duro was saying, looking at the quality of the relationships surrounding the use of the pieces. So yes, who benefits from our use of this? Who's benefiting from my buying the sheet music? But also, you know, what relationships do the living people, does the choir conductor have with the people who are writing this music, or the lives that go into it? These are things that we can't quiz the choir director on Sunday morning. Maybe we could, but they're kind of hard to see and know on Sunday morning when I'm in worship. Oh, that's appreciation. Oh, that's appropriation. It's just really difficult to measure by the symptoms. What we can do, I think, is to make more space, for instance, for the conversation surrounding the music that we use during worship, say when we continue along this sort of European concert model that says that the choir gets up, we say very little about what the choir is singing, and they sing to you for 2 minutes and you get what you get and then we're out. We're not encouraging deeper relationships with the life and the lifeblood behind the music. But if we started a conversation of deeper creativity, what would it look like for a service to be, for our service regularly to be powered and for us to derive wisdom from what the musicians have to say about what they know about the music? What if we were giving 7 or 10 minutes to that 2 minute piece so that the musicians could help us to understand what their journey was in understanding this? Maybe we can get into deeper starts to relationships between our congregants and our choir members and the music itself and that. So I'm not sure we can measure by the symptoms, but I think there are ways that we can begin deepening the conversation and encouraging a deeper relationship.
For years, lots of folks paying attention to this have talked about giving cultural context to music, to all of our music, and to all the things we do in worship. And I hear both of you talking about sort of a deeper relationship than even that little snippet of cultural context that people grudgingly give. And one of the things that, Duro, your testimony helped clarify for me, and yes, you might not want to know how viral it's gone, but I've watched it and thought it was magnificent, is that a lot of folks, I don't know exactly how to generalize this, but in order to use a piece of music, it also helps to understand what that piece of music actually means, right? And you talked in your testimony specifically about Peace Like a River, which is also in our hymnal, and about the fact that most white folks don't actually understand what that line means or where that came from. And I so appreciated learning what the deeper meaning is there. And I wonder how we can approach that with all of the music or all of the things that we do in worship. It's not even just music. I mean, you're two music directors, so we're talking a lot about music today. But it's about all the things we do in worship. Is there a deeper cultural meaning? That's just, I mean, we can say Peace Like a River comes from the spiritual tradition of the American slavery era, but that doesn't actually describe what you described in that testimony about what it means. I'm wondering how we create that space in our congregations, in our worship, outside of worship. Does it happen in the worship? I don't know. I don't know if you know, but I thought it would be interesting to talk about.
You know, I think it starts with there's a deeper understanding that starts with the acknowledgement that once a group of white people has taken on a piece of Black music, because of the experience of that group of people, the life experience of that group of people, because of the understanding that that group of people might have, it is no longer, in most cases, Black music. And there's got to be a sense of ownership of that, just because we do music that is taken out of Blackness. Once we have taken it out and we have infused it with our own understanding, our own life experience, it's in most cases no longer Black music. And I think Peace Like a River is a good example of that. And many of the things we do. Going back to our hymnals a little bit, we will see over and over and over again these pieces of music that started out in the Black church or maybe out in the plantations in a lot of cases, they have been very intentionally reworked so that they fit white liberal Unitarian Universalist understanding of spirituality or faith or social justice or whatever, and so they're they sound a lot like that Black song did. The example that comes to mind is "Sing to the Power of Love." I think it "Sings to the Power of Something" or other. I never use it, so I don't remember what it's called. But that is vastly different.
Now Let Us Sing, I think, is what you're talking about, right?
Thank you. Now Let Us Sing. That's the one. That's vastly different from how it's ever used in any Black church anywhere. But we still kind of call it that. We call it a gospel song in our hymnals, even though it sounds almost nothing like it, and it's the words are completely different, and the feel and the meaning have all been changed to fit what we do in Unitarian Universalist white liberalism. And that's another level of appropriation. And so I think it really starts with this level of understanding that just because it came from Blackness, once we have taken it on and added ourselves to it, it in most cases is not Black anymore.
Dora, I want to follow up with that, because first I want to ask, was that testimony part of the Portland white supremacy teach-in? I'm curious, is that what, that's where it came from? And the second question is what you just described a part of how music evolves, or is it simply a product of how white supremacy is showing up in our spaces? I don't know. I'm sincerely wondering, is this just part of how music evolves, or is this a part of how we, the United States, turns everything to the taste of the dominant culture?
I think it is. I think it can be how music evolves. I think there's this big question around among musicians about what is influence and what is stealing, and sure, America is a big place and a big diverse place. And we could talk about how that diversity happened, but I think most of us know it's we're gonna be influenced by each other. We're gonna have indigenous music, Latinx music, Black music. It's all gonna come into our understanding of what American music is, and we should let that happen. We should allow our perception of what music is change. Based on those influences. That's not the same as taking a historic piece of music I'll say two things. It's not the same as taking a piece of music and claiming it for yourself. So it's not the same as a group of white people saying the spirituals belong to us. And it's not the same as a white composer or arranger or songwriter saying, hey, look, I wrote a spiritual. Being influenced by the things around you and then being imitative of the things around you are two very different things. Does that answer your question, Aisha?
Yes, and I want to ask a question about, because I've been saying the word, and this is a little bit of a digression, misappropriation, but I hear you both say appropriation. Can you help me understand the difference? Because clearly I think I'm wrong.
I think they're the same word. Personally, I think that they're just, it's like regardless and irregardless, if they're the same word. The appropriation is the idea that I'm going to take something that does not necessarily belong to me or that I have no relationship with and use it for my benefit and I think sometimes the mis prefix is added when that is done as a misstep, when that is done insensitively or incorrectly. But I don't know, Glenn Thomas, you might have better ideas about that.
Well, I think of them largely similarly, although I hear some folks strike the difference of misappropriation tends to have some malice attached to it. So, appropriation happens all the time. And for many of us, it's like the bull in the china shop, but misappropriation has something to do with intent. I've seen people strike that difference.
Would intention in terms of misappropriation be a complete disregard for the sensitivity of what we're, whether you're going to sing something? Actually, I was thinking of Halloween's coming up, so it feels like those who just want to dress up as someone else's culture feels like, and not care that it's being insensitive, or I'm just, this is just funny or something. That's what it feels like would be the malintent.
You know what, I think a lot of this conversation could be more deeply anchored if congregations were to have a really clear understanding of the mission of their worship services. I am a huge advocate for sitting down and saying out loud and articulating those things which are assumed, especially in worship teams and in music teams, from the type of service you're going to do, and but also what kind of service you're providing. You know, what business is worship in? I think in that muck, we in the absence of a clear direction for so many of us, we make some assumptions about what the church should be doing in worship, or what we believe worship is, or what we have observed worship to be, and we make our expectations from those observations. So what we lack is a real unified sense or an anchoring place to go back to say, how is this, how is our music living up to the values that we hope to be practicing in worship specifically, not just in generally in the church, but in worship specifically. Otherwise, I think in the absence of that kind of clear understanding of mission, we will make judgments and decisions in such a stratus that we'll wind up dancing around the idea of what is appropriation and what is appreciation, because I think those questions come from the lens of what are you trying to achieve in worship? Are you trying to be a more culturally inclusive people? Is that what you're going after? Is there some other reason? And though I think those will tell you the kind of starting step for how music, how art, how words serve in the context of what you're trying to achieve.
You know, I'm just gonna follow up with on that a little bit. In Unitarian Universalist congregations specifically, for some reason, worship has come to this place of existing for social affirmation instead of spiritual development. And that is why a lot of these things, when they come up as questions or when we are challenged by a lot of these ideas, we feel a little bit affronted, because I didn't come to church to grow or to become better or to become challenged. I came to affirm that I have arrived as a solid liberal human being. And that is true in churches throughout the denomination, as far as I can see. We gather to affirm our, think about where you were the Sunday after the election this past year, and think about what the messaging was, and the disappointment that was in the room, and the fear that was in the room, because this is the idea that we have not arrived is not a common one in our churches. And so I think if we can start to have a conversation about what it means, what our worship services mean, as Glenn Thomas was pointing out, what are the reasons why we gather, and what is the place where we can come to for spiritual development and growth?
I cannot thank you enough for saying that, because one of the things that has been clear about people being so angry about the naming of white supremacy in liberal spaces is that we have not taught our people, I'm talking about Unitarian Universalists, to sit in discomfort. Exactly to your point, Dara, we've comforted the comfortable. And what do you mean that all my social justice work when I marched in the 60s doesn't count? I already did that. I marched in the 60s. I put up memes of Dr. Martin Luther King. And so I thank you so much for pointing out that we are not a spiritually mature people. So then we have folks who say, why are we doing so much social justice? I want to be spiritually fed. And I say, first of all, I don't know that there's really to even separate the two in the way I experience some people separating them. And it is white people. A is privilege, is because I don't want to be made uncomfortable. I just want to think about things that comfort me and my thing. So thank you for saying that. And that little, we have to make that into a meme, Meg, so that can go viral too.
Well, I'm happy to say there are lots of comments in YouTube this morning. Some of our former guests and friends of the show and some other folks. And so it's wonderful to see. I'll just lift up that Christina Rivera said that in the worship webinar, Decentering Whiteness in Worship Part 2, Glenn Thomas spoke about this. And Jessica has put that link over into YouTube. And Kimberly Hampton wrote, as someone with real ambivalence about both the gray and teal hymnals, I appreciate hearing Darrow, Glenn Thomas, and Aisha lift up No More Auction Block for me. Seems to be real agreement on that. Twinkle Marie Manning asked, how can we meet our desire to include diverse cultural music without culturally appropriating? And I think that's just what you've been talking about, is the depth and the relationships and the lived experience and the discomfort. So just to tell our live viewers that we started late. We had some problems. We'll go a few minutes late. Most of you are listening later anyway, but it's great to have you commenting and here. And I hear there are lots of amens over there too. So I say amen. This is such, I feel so lucky to have, this is just something complicated that I feel like it's, we could spend a lot of hours talking about this. Worship, the purpose of worship in Unitarian Universalist congregations, and why it's so wonderful to get to work with. And just to lift up, Glenn Thomas, that you are the worship and music director in Ann Arbor, and that I know that you've been really looking at some different models. We've had you on before talking about bringing music more in, stopping the separation of singing and speaking. And I wondered if you could talk about how that has changed worship in Ann Arbor, what you've noticed.
Well, I think we tend to plan worship services sort of the way you might write a piece of music or compose a poem, and we have the privilege and the luxury to have time to do that. But the some of the motivating ideas for me, one of the first things that I've tried to help us tackle is, I think we've become as a denomination over-reliant on the sermon-centric model of worship services, which I think not only discourages meaningful cultural interchange, but it also limits the type of learning styles and the people and the life experiences who effectively learn in another way other than the European lecture model. And so the conversation has been, first of all, how do we work to make the sermon a more democratic part of the worship service, so that it is feeding and fed by the other components, and frankly, how do we put a team together of people who are writers and singers and poets? How do we put a team together where no one feels they have to check a part of their expressive selves at the door in order to walk in and contribute? And what that's meant for us is we've begun to kind of subtly but in an ongoing way, reimagining the siloed positions of authority in our worship services. So it sort of began with my former boss and dear friend Gail Geisenhainer, who, when she was senior minister, would simply step up to the microphone while I was singing, and we turned that into duet. One time she did vocal percussion. I think it's on video somewhere on YouTube. It is a blessing for your whole life, okay? but then we started to work with the opposite of that. So we explored ways in which I could speak not only to the music, but to other areas of the worship service as more of a liturgist, and that sort of bleeding over of our traditionally siloed roles was how we started. ultimately, as we hoped, a snowball effect has kind of taken place, where every week there's something either subtle or major in the worship service that we can, that we see with fresh eyes, and we kind of take a left, a look at, and say, is there a reason we've been doing that in the same way for the last 20 years, or does anyone even know how that came about, and what fresh role is it serving for our people now? And sometimes we decide, oh, that needs to be completely changed. Other times we gain a deeper appreciation for its having been there in the first place. I'm not sure if I'm going far afield of the question, but I think the thesis that I'm trying to bring here is we've really tried to encourage a culture of a fresh eyes on what is traditionally a ritual-centered practice, to see time and time again what areas of our liturgy and our presentation is doing for our congregants, and when we need to improve upon them or nuance them in different ways.
Yeah. I would say, having been to Ann Arbor, what struck me was that people were in their bodies, it looked like, which really, honestly, I'm a white person, but I feel like for those of us who are really deeply embodied, sometimes it's lonely in the congregation. And I could feel a lot of bodies there with me in Ann Arbor. And I thought the music had a lot to do with that, about grounding. That's just how it felt.
We really do believe that embodiment is a necessary, vital, and healing work for modern people, especially modern white Americans. And the more we can encourage the visceral experience of life to pair with the academic and the kind of head experience, I think the easier it will be for us to understand what it's like to take our aspirations and our minds and our hearts and to channel them into the sort of action that changes lives and societies.
I'm going to jump in and say, here in Portland, we have a big churchy church. It's a very churchy church. And I have an Episcopalian background. And so I love that. I love the churchiness of it. I love the ritual. I love the solid liturgy. I love the pipe organ. I love all these things. And even though the official bounds of my job are not as broad as Dr. Rideout's are, although sometimes and often I pretend like they are, much to the annoyance of Bill, I'm sure. I've done since being here, it's to make our churchy church even more churchy, but to find depth and meaning and purpose in each ritual, in each element of the liturgy, in each song choice, and to find continuity and to find consistency in how we understand worship. And I think even though the approaches are different, I think they speak to the same thing. And that is, why are we here and what are we gaining from our time together? Pointing to whether it is through thinking way outside the box in terms of how we worship and bringing worship into our bodies, or it could be just a deep reflection of who we are in this space and in this time. There are different methods, and I think that there's room for all of it. I think part of Glenn Thomas and I are lucky because we're Black in these contexts, and if we want to do Black music, we just do it. And the problem with that is, for all of our colleagues that are not Black, when they want to do Black music, so often it is to bring a specific kind of energy or embodiment or affectation to the worship. And I don't have to worry about that. It's going to be there or it's not. If this music is appropriate, I get to do it and not have to think about that. but that's not common in our denomination. Usually when Black music is done, it is for this very express purpose of bringing this faux Blackness into the worship space.
Do either of you get pushback from folks who are made uncomfortable? And I don't know, would that have started after the teach-in or just in the last couple of years, but have you felt that you've introduced something, said something where you have white folks argue with you? I get it all the time as a religious educator, but I'm curious if you both get that as Black musicians.
You know, people will question the choices I make, but I have no problem saying, you have invited me here into this church to be with you, in some senses lead you. And I don't come without my Blackness. And so you don't get to tell me what parts of my Blackness I can bring and what parts I cannot. One of the key examples here in Portland is our organist, and sometimes our pianist, but usually our organist will start to play a little bit of music right at the end of the sermon when the preacher begins to pray. And that is directly yanked from my experience in Black churches. That's how we did things. And so some people have been uncomfortable with it. I either have to listen to the music or I have to listen to the prayer. I can't listen to both. It's distracting or whatever it is that they say. And I say, well, you know what? When I came here with my Black self, that is part of my Blackness that I brought. And hopefully there's something in that that you can gain.
Yeah, I experience pushback, but the direct pushback, it's not, first of all, it's not going to come to me. It's going to come to 15 places before it even gets my way. And by then it is translated and decimated for amusement and other. The way it often comes is packaged with the ongoing, way too often vitriolic conversation about Unitarian Universalism and its relationship to Christianity, Christ language, God language, and which I think is a beautiful conversation needing to be had by a relational pluralistic religious people, but the heat on it that often comes as criticism of me, my team, and our choices. Often in that commentary, you can find language that, if you are trained as a white person with racially conscious ears, or trained as a Black person or brown person growing up in America, you can simply hear the sentences that are pulled from other spaces in mind and heart. So that's often how it comes, and because just like with almost any conversation that has the sort of latent expressions of racism, they are hard to combat on their face. I don't have the privilege of saying those sorts of direct sentences that Duro was talking about as examples, although I am capable of them. They often aren't available to me because of the nuance and hidden nature of the racism and ageism in the larger conversation in general. So it's harder work, and it usually comes through the lens of let's talk about our healing our relationships with things like God language, Christianity, the Catholic Church. Let's talk about healing that and addressing our actual hurt, because underneath that is a deeper conversation that that is worth having, not only about our true wounds, but also about the sorts of discrimination that we perpetuate as protection mechanisms, as we endeavor to grow but fear it at the same time.
Wow, that's a whole nother show. I mean, thank you. That's happening. Somebody write that down. Thank you. But does anyone have any final thoughts? Meg, Michael, you both, this has been amazing. Thank you both so very much. This has been an incredibly rich conversation. Meg, Michael, you want to jump in with any final, or Duro or Glenn Thomas, do you have any final thoughts?
I just want to thank you for having me be a part of the conversation. What fun.
Jerome.
Likewise, thank you so much for inviting me to this conversation, even at this ungodly hour.
I will echo Aisha's thoughts, and I bet this will be a show that will get a lot of people listening and watching. Next week, we're going to have Adam Gerhardstein. He's a lawyer in Ohio whose career is focused on suing police and holding police accountable. He's currently helping the CLF to lead groups of people from cities who want to do that work. So he's going to be talking about what that work entails to actually hold police accountable for their behavior. Very specific work. I'm excited to bring him. Thank you again so much. This was really, I'm going to have to listen to it a few more times myself. So thank you.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.